This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
It's Government and Public Policy, Sunday night.
Greetings, welcome.
We probably need to fill in every available seat.
Because we have just about as many seats as we have people.
So, we want you to get to know each other.
Intimate.
All that good stuff.
Not.
You're the one who said intimate.
I'm sorry. So, welcome to the government and public policy track. Hopefully you're in the right place. I know many of you were trying to choose between this and other tracks, and we know you chose correctly. Because we're from the government, and we're here to help you make sure. So my name is Kurt Paulson, and I'm the track point, and I'm still trying to figure out what that means, but I teach urban and regional planning at University of Wisconsin-Madison. And
I am Amy Black. I teach American politics at Wheaton College, and I am the track chair. We think we know what that means, but we're not sure. But Kurt's sort of my
assistant.
I would say more my comrade, and he's definitely, together we have tried to sort of figure out how to spend this time and sort of envisioned the plan, and then I got to find the speakers. So if you like the plan, or don't like plan, blame him. If you like the speakers, don't like speakers, blame me. But you're going to love our speakers, so it's really not a problem. We are glad that you are all here. From what I have seen, from what they've showed me, we have a nice range of backgrounds, and we have a little intro coming later. We'll have more time to get to know each other tomorrow when we have a longer period of time. But just to kind of give you an overview of what we're hoping to do in this track. What Kurt and I really want us to do is to spend some time sort of thinking about how do we bring our faith to bear on issues of government and public policy, and thinking about even in the talk tonight, our plenary speaker talking about what does it mean to reach out to one another in love, and what does it really mean to love our neighbor. And I think it's important that as we have these discussions about politics, as we disagree, as we try to learn from one another, what we really want to model here is an opportunity to learn from one another, to hear from different perspectives, and to share from our experiences so that we all come out of this understanding and hopefully appreciating different Christian perspectives on government and public policy. So our goal is not to tell you what to think or to tell you the Christian way, but to help us model Christian community and Christian love for one another as we think about issues of government and public policy. So we thought about how to do this, and we decided the best way to get things started is where at least I find evangelicals seem to know the least, and that is talking about theology. So as my colleague Vince and I have discussed, it seems like many evangelicals know a lot about the Bible and biblical interpretation, but often theology sometimes hasn't always kind of worked its way in. So what we're going to do is we're going to start our time. Tonight's going to be much more of the sort of listen to interesting speaker, have interactive time, Q&A, but sort of sit here and stare at each other for a while. We have a wonderful speaker to help us understand political theology, talk about frameworks, kind of give us some ways to think about how we might bring our own faith and understanding of what it means to follow Christ to questions about government public policy. Tomorrow afternoon, we will have two presenters who will give us two different case studies, one from the realm of international relations, one from the realm of domestic politics. We'll be talking about reconciliation and immigration. Well, presenters will give us some background, give us some information, sort of tell us stories from their direct experiences. Then we'll be breaking into small groups, learning from one another, discussing, coming back together. So it will be a much more interactive time, and hopefully we'll learn a lot more that way. And then we'll bring it all together and sort of figure out what we learned in our final session on Tuesday night. Whatever that, I don't know what day it is right now, so I'm so confused after the holidays.
We're living in the holiday bubble.
That's right. So, and I have a daughter who wakes up at 5 o'clock in the morning, so this is way past my bedtime. But what can we do? All right. So without further ado, because we will be introducing ourselves, but we have a fabulous thing planned with our speaker, I would like to introduce our speaker for this evening, my colleague from Wheaton College, Vince Baycote, tell you a little bit about Vince. You'll learn a lot more just by hearing from him. He's the author of The Spirit in Public Theology, Approaching the Legacy of Abraham Kuyper. Might give you a little bit of a hint where he might be coming from theologically. He quotes Abraham Kuyper to describe the heart of the way he views theology in the Christian faith. quote, there is not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine. Dr. Bacot earned degrees from the Citadel, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and Drew University. He is currently an associate professor of theology and the director of the Center for Applied Christian Ethics at Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois, where he regularly teaches courses such as Gospel, Church, and Culture, Political Theology, most important for us, and Pneumatology. So please, let's have a nice round of applause for Vince Bacot.
Thank you, Amy. Appreciate that. It's great to be here, and it's great to try to do what I'm hoping to do in about 40 minutes. What we'd like to do to begin it with is to get a sense of where everybody's at in the room. So, we need to do this really, 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 really fast. Okay? So, starting over here, and then we'll just work our way all the way to the back. Tell us your name, your institutional affiliation, and your denomination. That way, I have some idea of who I'm talking to, and some sense, though probably not a great sense, but some sense of where you might be coming from in this track. So we'll start with...
Trevor Craig, Family Practice, not a faculty affiliated, although a minor medical students.
Okay, yeah, I'm a Baptist.
Great. Thank you. And that was so fast. That was amazing. That was great. It doesn't usually go that fast. So it's great to have such a cooperative group. Could you help me pass these out? I'm passing out a range of views from Catholic to Reformed. And you could actually thank Amy for this because it's basically from her book. And what I'm going to do is similar to this chart, but so some of the things that are on the chart I will mention, many of them I will not. One of the reasons why that is because I really don't want to insult your intelligence by reading a chart to you that you already have in your hand. And I know if I was in your position, I wouldn't want someone to be who's a speaker to just read a chart to me. So I'm going to... go over these views that you have in front of you. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you one or two distinctive doctrines from each view. Then sort of their view of the state or government. Then what I see as a distinctive emphasis or two from each view. The view of the church in relationship to the state. And then the whole question about Christian participation in the world. Now, we have until 10 o'clock and it's 9:15, and obviously I'm not going to give you the deepest discussion of all of these views. What I want to do is give you a very concise snapshot of it and try to set a frame of reference for you for these views. But before doing that, let me talk about why I think it's important that we talk about evangelicals, politics, and theology. The best way I think I can illustrate it is to say that when it comes to the way that I think evangelicals deal with politics and bring their theology to it, in terms of sort of their readiness to be involved in public life, the best analogy for me is to think about a basketball team and who starts and who's on the bench. And, you know, years ago, when the Detroit Pistons won the NBA championship, you always knew when the game was definitely out of reach because there's a guy that would only get in the game when the game was completely out of reach. They called him the human victory cigar. All right? So... he only got in with maybe a minute or two to go. Now, here's the thing about that. The human victory cigar guy is not a guy you want starting in the game. Okay? It's someone you only put in the game when the stakes just don't matter. And frankly, I think that the way that most evangelicals are prepared to engage public life They're kind of like the Human Victory cigar guy. All the way at the end of the bench, somebody who's happy to get in the game, at least at some point, just loves to run around, throw up a few threes, they're just happy to be out there, but you don't want them in the game when something significant is on the line. Now, unfortunately, I think that's the way evangelicals broadly are when it comes to being engaged in public life. Now, it's true that in the last, say, 10, 15 years, it hasn't even been much of a question about whether evangelicals should be involved in public life. But with this greater entrance into public life, there hasn't necessarily been the preparation, in my view, especially theologically, for evangelicals to really know why they're doing what they're doing. It's like, hey, I'm just happy to be here. And the problem is the stakes are too high to just be happy to be there. So that's why I think it's important to discuss political or public theology. If we take our faith and our lives on earth seriously, how do we think about things like church and state with appropriate complexity? If you talk about something as simple as the pursuit of justice, how do we actually think about what justice is and how we put that into practice? How do we really do that? How do we think of really what a Christian ought to be doing in a society? And to make it a bit more complex, how do you think about what a Christian's role is in a society depending upon the kind of society in which you find yourself? So I think a lot of these questions are not questions that, in my view, the general evangelical populace has dealt with that well. So a question to put in the back of your minds while I'm talking here is this. How did you arrive at your understanding of the relationship of theology, the relationship of faith to politics, or the relationship of faith to what we would call public life more broadly, more generally? Where did it come from? Where did you learn it? What did you read, or what did you hear? What were you taught? So it's just an important question, I think, to ask when it comes to this very, very, very important issue. So, with that, now to the whirlwind tour of some representative views. And I want it to be a whirlwind tour because as much as I like to do public speaking, I think it's important that we actually have conversation about these views as opposed to me, waxing rhapsodic for like 40 minutes. So, we'll start with the oldest tradition, Roman Catholicism. So, what distinctive doctrine do I want to highlight from that? That's the doctrine of the Incarnation. In other words, the fact that God became flesh. Here we are at Christmas time, kind of an appropriate time to talk about Incarnation. The Incarnation is important in terms of Roman Catholicism because it affirms the dignity of humanity. It affirms the goodness of life in the world. Jesus becoming human, taking on flesh, I like to say, in a way, it echoes Genesis 1:31, that God's creation is very good. So it's kind of that kind of idea. So in Roman Catholicism, there's an affirmation, basically, of the dignity of humanity, the goodness of creation. When it comes to the state and the government and a view of that, the way to think of it is like this. The goal of the state is to be oriented towards the temporal happiness of humanity. In other words, so the goal for government is to be concerned with the flourishing of human life here on terra firma. That's its goal. It's seen as part of the created order, and it's distinct, clearly distinct from the church, though not with a very strong barrier between them. Now, flowing from that view of state and government, when you think about sort of the ways that one might make arguments for policy or public life generally, there are two things that I want to highlight. The first is the role of natural law. And here is an incredibly basic conception of natural law, which it's good to know there are others that could probably give a more complex version if necessary. The idea is that within humans, there is the capacity for humans, whether they're Christian or not, to at least have a basic level of understanding and apprehension about certain things. Things that we would call things that are good for the entirety of humanity. So if one wants to make certain kinds of arguments about why we ought to have a good society, then the point is that you don't need to appeal to special revelation to make your arguments. You're making an appeal about things being just or good that you can, to a degree, because there's not complete agreement across the tradition about this, but to a degree that people can hear this argument and basically understand each other, and hopefully, if they understand each other, then one can advocate for the best options for a good society. So there's the potential for a kind of universal appeal there, one would say. So natural law is very, very important. A second thing is there's this principle called subsidiarity, the principle of subsidiarity. So the idea is this. If you think about the state as this one whole thing, and individuals are part of the state, various institutions are part of the state, you think of it this way. There's a hierarchical structure in the state, and those things that are at the highest levels only come into play when the things at a lower level, whether it's the individual or smaller communities, let's say, only when they are not able to meet certain needs on their own. Once they're not able to meet those needs on their own, then the things at the higher level come in and help out with that. So it meets needs which can't be fulfilled or handled by these lower communities. So when you're thinking about an individual's ability to arrive at or practice certain rights, if there's something, let's say the structure of society, that is preventing the individual from doing that, then you may need these larger communities to come in and help make that a possibility. What about the church? The church, there's the possibility of cooperation between the state and the church. Now, notice we said cooperation. We didn't say being co-opted or anything like that. We'll get to a view that makes that argument later. But here, the point is that there's possibility for cooperation between state and church, though they're not seen as identical. The church and state are definitely distinct. Like I said, the state gets to the temporal happiness of man. The ultimate goal of the church is the eternal happiness of humans. Okay? What about Christian participation? Yes is the answer for Christian participation, whether it's serving in the military, whether it's voting, whether it's running for public office. There's not prohibitions on Christian individuals from participating in the various areas of government in our society. All right, so that's Roman Catholicism. So now, the beginning of the Lutheran perspective here. Distinctive doctrine for the Lutheran view, surprise, surprise, justification by faith. What I want to emphasize about justification here is that justification identifies God's unique and God's act alone in saving his people. Salvation for us in Christ, that is God's work alone. So there's nothing we can contribute to it. It's God acting for us when we are helpless and unable to do anything for ourselves. One of the interesting things about this way of talking about it, with Luther and with Lutheran tradition, there's this interesting phrase. It's a Latin phrase, simul justus et peccator, which means simultaneously just and sinner. The whole point is that we, in our experience of our lives, we may experience ourselves as sinners, but the word of the gospel to us is that God has acted to justify you, to declare you not guilty. And as you go through life, you may have this experience of feeling like a sinner, but you hear the word of the gospel constantly telling you that you are justified. The biggest thing I want to emphasize is the point of God being the one that acts and God acting alone. Because what that sets up is sort of the idea of the view of the state and government. In the Lutheran conception, you have what you call a two kingdoms hypothesis. So the idea is you've got the kingdom of the world, and then you've got God's kingdom. You don't want to confuse God's kingdom and the kingdom of the world. Okay? I mean, the kingdom of the world isn't a bad thing, but it's not God's kingdom. And in the kingdom of the world, I mean, you have things like government, commerce, etc. Okay? And they're good things in the created order, but they're not to be confused with the kingdom of God. Now, with that view, the distinctive emphasis is you want to strongly maintain that distinction. Christians should aim to live faithfully in the world, as citizens of both kingdoms, but you don't want to try to Christianize the kingdom of the world. You might want things to improve, but you don't want to try to save it. You don't want to do that. I mean, you might hope for things to be better, but you don't try to bring the kingdom of God to the kingdom of this world. The kingdom of God is God's kingdom, and God alone will act to bring about his kingdom in his due time. The view of the church. The church can have an indirect influence. Indirect influence. That indirect influence comes through the way that people are nurtured and developed within the church and how they participate in the various areas of society. But it's also the church or denominations. I mean, they can do things like perhaps do pastoral letters about certain issues in society, but that you resist the idea of trying to do things like tell people how to vote. You don't do that. Okay? But you may give position papers, let's say. By the way, a good book for the Lutheran perspective, a guy named Robert Benny, B-E-N-N-E, called The Paradoxical Vision. Very short article that gives you a summary of the book in Pro Ecclesia from about 10, 11 years ago, if you want to see a good example of this. Christian participation, yes, individuals can participate in whatever area of society, no problem. But clergy would not be, you know, the ideal people, just like they wouldn't be ideal in any of these views. So, let's speed along to the next, Anabaptist. Now, the interesting thing I want to point out about this is that there are versions of this that I would say have become increasingly popular in evangelicalism in the last 15 years. And I think one of the reasons why is because of the distinctive doctrine. The distinctive doctrine is ecclesiology, the doctrine of the church. The primary allegiance for Christians is to Jesus and to participating in this community that is the church. Okay, that is your world, let's say, in this view. And it's important to be that distinctive community. Very, very important. So ecclesiology is very, very significant. And the reason I think that this has been attractive to many evangelicals is, well, to put it bluntly, we had a conference a few years ago about the evangelical doctrine of the church, and we jokingly thought about calling it In Search of Evangelical Ecclesiology. The point being that there isn't much of an evangelical ecclesiology. So if there isn't much of an evangelical ecclesiology, then you start reading people that have a strong ecclesiology, well, you know, it's kind of attractive. When people start talking about, hey, maybe we really ought to think about this church thing, meaning something other than voluntary association. So I think that's one of the most attractive things about it. What should we as church be doing? So I think it's very attractive to many people. So you read Yoder and Howard Watts, for example, and are energized by it. The view of the state and government. Government's necessary because of the fall, but there is a very strong distinction between church and state. Again, you have to have your allegiances in order. Your allegiance is to Jesus. And the people that have their allegiance to Jesus are God's community, the church. You don't want to tamper with that. You don't want to be tempted by confusing your allegiance with an allegiance to the state. Now that leads to a distinctive emphasis, which is maintaining that strong distinction between the church and state, which one of the ways I like to say it is you want to resist the Constantinian temptation. Now what do I mean by resisting the Constantinian temptation? The basic idea is this. Things were going well in terms of being distinctive Christians until around the year 313. That's when the emperor Constantine got converted. And what happens after the emperor gets converted? Well, Christianity becomes the religion of the state. This is the narrative, okay? So the way John Howard Yoder puts it in the Constantinian Sources of Western Social Ethics is to say that after Constantine, being a citizen was equivalent to being a Christian. And what took incredible conviction was to not be considered a Christian. So the point then is you want to resist this lure of, to put it kind of crassly, getting in bed with the state, and you want to maintain your identity as God's community, as people who follow Jesus and who don't try to use the means of the state to accomplish the aims of the kingdom. Okay? I mean, that's the idea. Okay? So you want to resist the Constantinian temptation. And second, there is a strong commitment to nonviolence. Okay? So a commitment to do no harm. And the point is not that that people are committing to be doormats. So it's just very, very important to say that, because I think sometimes when people, they go, oh, well, you know, I mean, how can you protect anything, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So to which I would say, just hang out with Mennonites that have been around that kind of, they've done it for a while, and then find out how they do nonviolence. That's the best way to put it, yeah. Yeah. So that's a very distinctive emphasis. The view of the church, I like to say it this way. The church is an alternate polis. Okay? In other words, it's a different body. Modeling a different community, a different politics, different priorities. And in doing that, it is a witness to the rest of the society about what the kingdom of God looks like. So then people see how this community lives, and then they're prompted to ask, why do you do what you do? And then, you know, this is an opportunity to say, this is what the kingdom of God looks like. But it's living as an alternate polis rather than trying to use the structures of society to embody any aspects of kingdom reality. Christian participation, questionable. For example, there is not agreement, as I understand it, about things like voting or about things like whether a person can run for office. Okay? There's debate within this view about that. Okay? So you'll have some Mennonites and Anabaptists who vote, some who might even be interested in running for office, and then some who would find that to be really, 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 well, perhaps scandalous. So there's no consensus on that. But there is agreement on like being conscientious objectors. So there's consensus on that, let's say. All right. Then finally, and it's not because I'm a neo-Calvinist, but finally there is, generally speaking, what we'll call a Reformed view. Two distinctive doctrines, creation and divine sovereignty. The point about creation is the affirmation of creation as God's good creation and as God's creation for which humans have responsibility. Okay? In other words, rather than seeing redemption, for example, as something that is against creation, redemption is seen as the renewal of creation, the fulfillment of creation. So there's a strong emphasis on our responsibility in it rather than seeing being a Christian as waiting for your escape from it. Sovereignty is important because there's the belief about God being sovereign over everything. And one wants to live faithfully under the sovereign God. And also, when we get down to distinctive emphases, there's one theory about the way, about the structure of society that derives from God's sovereignty. So the view of state and government. Government is part of how things work out in the created order. One could say the government is an agent of common grace. What's common grace? Reader's Digest version. Common grace is God's preserving, restraining, sustaining action in the world that makes possible faithful Christian participation in the world. It makes it possible for Christians to continue to obey the cultural mandate, Genesis 1, 26, and 28, after the fall. It makes that still possible. So in other words, Genesis 3 doesn't mean, sorry, the world's fallen, you can't do anything, just run around and wait for Jesus to come back. It means that it's harder to obey the cultural mandate, but it's still possible. So common grace makes Christian participation in society still a live option. Okay, so distinctive emphases, strong emphasis on transformative participation in every area of life. So in other words, Christians, whether they're involved in politics, whether they're involved in art, whether they're involved in education, they should be people who are seeking to lead to the flourishing of creation in all in those areas. Second, there is this idea of the structure of society that Abraham Kuyper mentioned called sphere sovereignty. Sphere sovereignty basically means this. God is sovereign over everything, that has created the world in such a way that there is a derivative sovereignty that manifests itself in various social spheres. So you have the family is one sphere. Education is one sphere. Business is one sphere. Government is one sphere. The church is a sphere. And Kuyper didn't really say how many spheres there were. Okay, so it depends upon what you're reading, frankly. But the point is that these are all social structures that have, if you will, their own integrity. And within these social spheres, they, in a sense, have their own independence. And other spheres can't impinge upon these others in sort of telling them what to do. In other words, this is why a pastor can't tell somebody who's in government what to do. Okay, I mean, the guy who's in government might go to church there, but he's not being told how to govern by this guy. That's why, by the way, when people criticize this view as being Constantinian, they misunderstand the way that it's set up. You can't have Constantinianism with the way that it's set up, because church can't tell people what to do over here. It can equip people to be faithful, but it can't dictate to them how to govern. Okay, so that's a very, very, very important thing to note. It's distinguished from subsidiarity, which I mentioned earlier, in the sense that it's more horizontal in this way, where subsidiarity has a hierarchical sort of structure, and also with sphere sovereignty, each of the spheres maintains its own integrity. It's on its own. Whereas in subsidiarity, you're thinking about the state as a whole, and there are various parts of it within the hierarchy. It's a brief distinction between them. All right, view of the church. It's also distinct, but similar to some other views, you can have indirect influence. Again, someone can be certainly taught by what happens in the church, but you don't have the church dictating policy. Doesn't happen. Church doesn't make policy. Okay? So, it's only influence is indirect. Number five, Christian participation. Yes, absolutely. Strong emphasis on transformation and the flourishing of creation in all of these spheres. So, go on to these, but you'll notice that there's not a category on your sheet called evangelical. That's because there's no consensus under the umbrella that we call evangelical. It makes room for a variety of traditions. There are people who pick and choose, sometimes evangelicalism, from these various aspects. And also, I mean, the evangelical tradition itself, I mean, you've got this interesting history where prior to the Civil War, you've got this post-millennial zeal where there's a strong desire to make the world better. Civil War comes around, kind of makes people a little less optimistic. Then you get Reconstruction and a lot of things in the latter part of the 19th century that also kind of make it harder to be an optimist. So you eventually get a withdrawal, the emergence of fundamentalism, and then this re-engagement with neo-evangelicalism, 1940s, and you begin to get a re-engagement in society, particularly in terms of people participating in politics and the culture, kind of late 60s, and picking up in the 70s, 1976 being the year of the evangelical, for example. And until we get to this point now where I'm talking about where people don't question whether the evangelical should be involved, though now after the last 8 years people have all these different kinds of sense of ambivalence about what it means to be involved in society. So you've got this mixed bag. And what kind of mixed bag is it? It's a mixed bag that has a diversity that ranges from people that are what you might call Shane Claiborne devotees over here, okay, to Dobson, you know. I mean, and they're all under the umbrella evangelical, okay? And if you ask them about certain things that are evangelical identifiers, about your view of the Bible, your view of Jesus, the vague view of church, one might say, you'll see that there's significant overlap that puts them all under this umbrella.
Can you give the 1 minute explanation of who Shane Claiborne is for
people? I guess because he's like, you know, all over the place. Shane Claiborne is a very interesting fellow who leads this group called The Simple Way. Outside Philly, but they're also like involved near Trenton or something like that, right? So he wrote a book called Jesus for President, and Shane strongly influenced certain people, like some students of mine, not to vote. Okay, why? Because at one level, I mean, it's like a variant of saying, look, we need to take the responsibility of church seriously, do what church needs to do, and just be about our business. And not, and it's almost like saying, if you vote, is that a commitment saying that somehow you're expecting government to be taking responsibility that you ought to be taking as church? So, I mean, it's kind of that idea. But Shane's been very, very influential with a lot of people. Nice guy. You would definitely notice him if you saw him because he's got these long braids. So he's definitely, I would say, a variant of the person that's influenced by Yoder and Hauerwas and that's trying to live in intentional community. I mean, the thing about it is whatever you think about Shane's view, I mean, he's living it. Okay? I mean, he is living it. He is not just an ideologue. I mean, it is on the ground. So that's Shane Claiborne. I probably don't need to explain who Dobson is. I don't think, right? Okay. So you got that. But the point is that I'm using those as kind of like poles there, because all these people you would call evangelical. Now, there are some people, yes, who say, well, I'm not so sure I want to identify as evangelical. But see, they're working out their stuff when they say that, okay? Because if you ask them, you know, when nobody's around and they don't have to save face or something, what do you believe? Then, well, you know, it's like, yeah, you sound kind of evangelical to me. So the point is that, I mean, there's a lot of diversity in evangelicalism, and the fact is that evangelicalism is broad, but it also tends to be theologically diffuse. Because it's theologically diffuse, it's hard to say there's any kind of distinctive evangelical public engagement. And that's why there's not a evangelical option that I'm presenting to you. I would say that evangelicals tend to draw from pretty much the views that we that have been given to you, or hybrids thereof. So the question, I think, for us is, I mean, how do you become more deep and complex in our theological engagement with politics? And really, I mean, what do we need to do to get off the bench? You know, so that you are somebody that gets in the game, and when it's on the line, you're the person they want in there, as opposed to the person to say, oh gosh, here they come. Right? I mean, I think that's I think the big question. And there are 13 minutes left, so I'm going to stop. All right? So, questions, clarifications, elaborations, protests, what have you. I'm happy to entertain that. He was first on. Sorry. Okay, John.
History of fights within the traditions that you described. Mm-hmm. Can you say a little more about the fight within the Reformed tradition? Kuyper did take a different direction. There's a huge fight over common grace, mm-hmm. That most of us don't fully
sure.
comprehend.
Right.
But it has an immense effect on the discussion within evangelicals.
Sure. So the question is, particularly, for example, things like the Reformed tradition where people have fights about things like common grace, is this perhaps part of the problem for evangelicals? I mean, in other words, so people call themselves Reformed, but which Reformed are they, for example? Is that a fair way to put it? Okay. So what about, like, for example, what is the debate about common grace? Well, some people don't think common grace exists. There's some people who would say, look, if it's grace, it's special. It's not common. And if it's special, it's particular, as in it's an electing, saving grace. And they're hesitant to call common grace grace because they want to identify grace only with God's work in saving the elect. And in the Reformed tradition, certainly, those who are strictly of a very strong double predestinarian bent might want to resist the notion of common grace, although Kuyper was a strong double predestinarian. But some double predestinarians, they're like, I start with the decree. Okay, the decree from eternity past that God is going to save certain people and not save others. Okay, the decree of election and reprobation. So if they start with that and they go, grace is the outworking of that, then they only want to talk about grace that way. The other thing is that for some people, common grace is a fast track to secularism because it so emphasizes being involved as a Christian in every area of life, and it becomes so emphasized as being involved in every area of life that people are great on saying, I want to be a Christian lawyer or doctor or politician, but they're kind of short on piety. Or they almost snicker at piety. And they would never understand why anybody would want to go into ministry. And I think that's a fair critique, but that's not Kuyper. A guy who wrote tons of devotionals and was prime minister. So their beef isn't with Kuyper. Their beef is with people misappropriating tradition. But how often does that happen with any tradition? You know. But I do think I think that's a fair question. I mean, if people find, if someone reads about common grace and gets into the tradition, then they're like, whoa, what's all this stuff going on? And it can certainly lead people to have varying emphases and questions about the extent to which they would want to be zealous in their public engagement. So I think that's certainly, I think, one of the ways that there can be difficulty. Because you get you on the one hand there's a kind of robust deep tradition, but then there are all these fights about it, and it's like, okay, what am I getting into with all this stuff? So I think that can be one role for sure. Although honestly, I don't think if we polled evangelicals in America and you said define common grace, then many of them would be able to tell you what it is. If you described it, I think they would. But I don't think that they would call it common grace. They would say, oh, well, you know, it's just commonsensical. God, we're here. The world goes on. and we have a responsibility. But how that responsibility ranks against other evangelical priorities, I think, is another challenge. You had your hand up first, then.
I'm interested in knowing what your definition is of James Dobson on the other end of the spectrum. Just how you would define that spectrum.
How I would define that? I would define that as a version of evangelicalism that strongly emphasizes finding ways to influence public opinion and policy decisions. It's not at all reticent about using government. I think in some ways, both whether I'm talking about Shane or whether I'm talking about Dobson reflects the fact that evangelicalism does have a tendency towards being personality driven. It's just which personality. I think that's sort of the simplest way that I would want to put that. I mean, and certainly Shane's politics and James Dobson's politics aren't the same. So, I mean, James Dobson would be, you know, a certain kind of Republican, and Shane would be
non-voting independent.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's some kind of independent, is what I would say.
I wanted to propose a fourth tradition.
Oh, sure, yeah, sure.
I think
of what?
For your typology. I think that
a fifth.
The dominant theological influence in evangelicalism from like the 1960s to today has been just Southern white evangelicalism justifying slavery, and then after the Civil War, the cause law theology that grew up around the Southern Baptist Convention.
Sure.
Basically justifying a very traditional, very authoritarian, almost social order, limited government, racial dominance, a very unequal distribution of wealth, limited investment in public infrastructure of any kind. And
I wouldn't call that only Baptist.
Well,
there are a lot of Presbyterians, Southern Presbyterians, kind of love that.
The Southern Baptist Convention was sort of the most... All I'm saying is, I think that is it may not be an intellectually respected tradition, but I think it's had a huge influence. And
The reason I would put that on there is because I don't think it's as explicit enough in evangelicalism broadly conceived. I do think that it's one of the streams that that shows how aspects of American culture infiltrate versions of Christianity, and that one then unwittingly weds certain cultural perceptions or one clothes them with biblical language.
Well, I don't think it's normatively biblical, but I think it's actually been the dominant stream.
I don't know, I mean, because dispensationalism, for example,
yeah.
I mean, I'd say dispensationalism way more dominant in the broader culture, in terms of leading people to withdraw from culture and to think that the your main priority is about preparing to evangelize people, and because you have a negative conception of history, you don't, you're hesitant about how much you want to engage in the political or even invest energy in learning about all that. You have certain core commitments, and it's okay to vote for those, but you don't want to necessarily tell people that they need to be investing time in being like the best politicians, the best lawyers, etc. So.
May I respond as the author of this?
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure, she wrote, it's her book now.
We believe in authorial intent.
Yes.
The purpose here is to look at the four sort of dominant historical traditions of political theology. So these are long-standing, centuries-old, obviously developed over time, traditions about political theology, and there are many other theological traditions that are important, but there are many streams of theology that don't really have a strongly held political theology, per se. But the issues that you raise, and I think these will be some of the conversations that we have over our time together, are really important. What are these other cultural influences, theological influences, biblical interpretation influences? There's all these other influences that are important, but they're not in the chart, but they're relevant. And I think that gets back to Vince's question at the very beginning. how do we arrive at our understanding of the relationship between our faith and public life, and thinking about what are the different sort of pieces, those inputs that come into our own lives, and as we share those with one another, and some things that we may accept, we may reject, but those influences are going to be a part. So I think you're raising really important questions and things that aren't in the church because it doesn't fit the church, but very much fit the larger discussion.
The last thing I would say about that from my vantage point is that there's one sense in which I would say a general conception of whiteness like influences things, okay, of which what you described is one variant. But it's more something that I think is subterranean influence that's kind of like the air people breathe, rather than being an actual, you know, similar to what Amy was saying, theological. Yeah. System.
Maybe coming back to this theological undergirding for political participation and understanding and involvement, I have a question with Andy Crouch's seminar this morning sort of in mind about what you see as
culture making. Just kidding.
Well, yeah. Okay. As useful institutional encouragements to evangelical believers who want to get involved in public life. As you look across. The spectrum. I've heard a little bit about the Center for Public Justice's Civitas program, a little bit about the Pew Younger Scholars programming that has now largely disappeared. Are there other spaces in which the theological richness that's presumed in some of these traditions is taught in a way that prepares people for public life?
My short answer is not a whole lot. I mean, but I think the point is they've got to be made. They've got to be built. You know? I think that's kind of the point about, one of the ways that if we're going to get from being the 12th man to being the first option, then I think it requires the construction of doing the work of having, more than one CPJ, for example. So I'm sure that if I did a survey of like everything that was out there, I'm sure that there's, there are various think tanks, let's say, but are they like tractor beams for most people? Probably not. So, it's like 10 o'clock. And I really, really, really want to answer questions, but I also don't want to violate the time. So, okay, wait. So, you had your hand up a long time ago.
Yeah.
So,
I hope to leave here with something that's practical that I can take back to my work. I work in local government. As opposed to the theory that I could, read about in a book or watch on TV, and something like the homosexual agenda, like if they would come to watch to like Chicago, they would like split hairs. They're like, okay, what can we do? Let's come together. I know we're different views. Let's come together. What can we do? What have we done wrong? Let's change what we've done wrong. With some practicality, I hope to do that.
Well, you will. I'm just starting out. I'm the theory guy who's starting it out. Okay. So, in other words, my goal is. But I would want to say this. Whatever kind of pragmatism one wants to have, your pragmatism doesn't happen in a vacuum. There's still some idea about why decide that you're going to have a coalition with people you disagree with. What's going to be the basis of which things you agree with and don't agree with? There's still going to be something behind that. There's some idea behind that. There's going to be some theological commitment that's going to influence that. So I don't want to. I guess what I want to say is, I don't want to have a false dichotomy between theory and practice. That's one of the reasons why, to me, public theology, political theology, is very important. I think the problem is that evangelicalism has been strong on zeal. Again, this is like the Mark Noble critique. Strong on zeal, weak on theory, you might say. We need both. It's not an either or. So, I like both. So I'm with you, but we have commitments with our practice.
Well, one of the rules of comedy is leave them wanting more.
Maybe that's true. So we have all of tomorrow.